The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A lot to get to once again on today's program. Coming up in the next segment, the second half of the show, we'll continue our Bible study from yesterday, looking at the subject of New Jerusalem. There's quite a vision in that subject. In fact, one that we need to, as God says over and again in the Bible, that we need to wrap our minds around and really stay grounded in, to give us hope and to fill us with joy. New Jerusalem coming up in the next segment. Also today, quite a lot of news to get to. And speaking of that, by the way, the several really important stories right now at thetrumpet.com. There's a feature, I believe this is in the February issue, America's Retreat from Global Leadership. That's at the top of the page right now. It's by Andrew Miller, and that, as I say, is in our print version, the February 2018 print version of the Trumpet magazine. And we'll come back to this article a little bit later on in this first segment, because it does tie right in with another piece from the Observer. Also, just again, to keep you up on what's happening in Europe, weapon proliferation in Eastern Europe, that too is at thetrumpet.com right now. And then another one about an archaeological find in Jerusalem, a 2,700-year-old seal revealing a biblical rank, a rank discussed in the Bible. In 2 Kings 23 and 2 Chronicles 34, this article is by Christopher Eames, by the way. And it says here, this is the first archaeological confirmation of the ancient biblical rank of city governor. That's what it says on this seal that's 2,700 years old. Chris says here, of course, there's no way of knowing which governor this official seal belonged to. The Bible clearly mentions two, Joshua and Messiah, and based on the dating, it may well have belonged to Joshua, Hezekiah's governor. Of course, the Hezekiah seal was discovered a couple of years ago by Dr. Elat Mazar. Chris brings that out in his piece. And then, of course, you have the other bulle that we've even had on display at Armstrong Auditorium, Jehu Kol and Gedaliah, Jeremiah's persecutors. But a lot, it seems, coming up from the ground from that period of King Hezekiah's reign. Wouldn't that be something? There's no definite name on this particular seal, as Chris brings out. But given the dating, this could be the one that belonged to Joshua, Hezekiah's governor. So some important stories, as I say, from thetrumpet.com. And one, in the case of that last one there, that pertains to Jerusalem. As I said on yesterday's program, Jerusalem today, I mean, what a contrast when you look at the city of Jerusalem today. I mean, aside from these archaeological finds, that's pretty exciting when you look at the city today. But leaving that aside, as I said on the program yesterday, I mean, there's so much about the city of Jerusalem that's not to be desired, because as my father says in the Zechariah booklet, it's a disunited city that's plagued by violence. And really, it's a symbol of this tragic world. It's a symbol, Jerusalem today. It's nothing like the Jerusalem to come. Certainly not like New Jerusalem. What a symbol, though, this city is today of this entire tragic world. Iran is cracking down on dissent, as we talked about yesterday. I think it's now 22 people that have been reported as having been killed since the protests began 5 or 6 days ago. 22 people. President Rouhani said yesterday that the Iranian security forces they're going to take action, he said, against these rioters and lawbreakers. That's what he's calling them. And yet, as the Times of London pointed out this morning, tens of thousands of people took to the streets over the night in defiance against this order. And nine more died as a result, bringing the total to at least 22 people. That's going on in Iran. And I noticed just before coming down here that President Trump again tweeted that the United States is watching. But that's about all that the U.S. does these days. As this Observer piece that I'll get to in a moment brings out, I mean, there's a dearth of leadership in the United States and Britain. And more, you see the United States, just like Andrew Miller says in the latest Trumpet magazine, more and more, you see the U.S. on the sidelines, just watching. That's all that we're doing. Sure enough, it was said in the tweet just a half hour ago. America is watching. America's watching while the world is burning. There's a piece at Deutsche Welle about the growing anti-Semitism in Germany. There have been several reports in recent weeks, but this one here is based on an interview with, I think the woman's a former president. It says here, a former president of the Central Council of Jews in Germany, Charlotte Knobloch. According to DW, it says she voiced grave concern Friday over growing anti-Semitic sentiment in the country. She said that public Jewish life is under threat and can only be lived out in public with police protection and under the most serious security precautions. I mean, if you want to be an observant Jew, and for so many of those observant Jews, it is an open display. And if it's going to be out in the open, there needs to be security. There needs to be police protection. That's what she's saying here. Knobloch pointed out the fact that Hanukkah celebrations in Berlin and Munich, as well as the large menorahs installed in both cities, were by necessity accompanied by massive around-the-clock police protection. A large menorah installed in the city of Heilbronn, for instance, was attacked and damaged by vandals. And this article brings out how that there was a recent study, I think back in April of last year, that found that Jews in Germany were facing increasing anti-Semitism just in their everyday lives. There have been other examples just in the news as well, a video that surfaced of an older German persecuting a Jew, shouting down a shop owner. That's a disturbing trend in modern Germany. You look in the United States, and of course the U.S. has a lot of trouble with its cities. The end of the year, the calendar year, is upon us. As I said yesterday, that's the time when you tally up all the stats and the figures. And in some cases, those stats they paint just a horrible picture. In Baltimore, for example, 343 homicides last year, 2017. Nearly one every day. That's about the average now in Baltimore. It's a new record. A new record for murder in the city of Baltimore. The other day, NPR had a fascinating interview, very revealing, in fact. This is with a Baltimore pastor named Kenji Scott. And he says the problem is that the police in the city have pulled back in the wake of the Freddie Gray case. Imagine that. He's saying the police are gone. After all of that bad publicity from a couple years ago, and now it's record-setting homicides. Here's a bit from that exchange on NPR. This is the reporter asking the question, and the answer here is by Pastor Kenji Scott, who is, as I say, from the Baltimore area. Clip one.
After the death of Freddie Gray, yourself, families of victims, didn't you want police to back off?
No. That represented our progressive, our activists, our liberal journalists, our politicians. but it did not represent the overall community. Because we know for a fact that around the time that Freddie Gray was killed, we start to see homicides increase. We had 5 homicides in that neighborhood while we were protesting. What I wanted to see happen was that people would build a trust relationship with our police department so that they would feel more comfortable with having conversations with the police about crime in their neighborhood because they would feel safer. So we wanted the police there. We wanted them engaging the community.
That's a pastor from the Baltimore area. A black pastor who's saying, look, we didn't want the police to leave. The ones who wanted that were the progressives, the activists, the liberal journalists. The liberal journalists sitting in their gated neighborhoods somewhere far away. They wanted the police to back off, and that's what happened. And now look who suffers. This pastor talks about some of the recent murders. A 31-year-old on his way to the store, a 19-year-old off to his college class, just gunned down in the city of Baltimore. Are the liberal journalists and progressives, are they listening to this report from the streets of Baltimore, from one of the local pastors? Do they hear the alarm bells? This is when we need the police. It's not to say that there aren't ever any cases of police brutality or excessive force, but this is not the problem. It's just the opposite. There's not enough force on the streets. And this is brought out actually over at Hot Air. An example from the Washington Post. I think this is around the Baltimore area. But it says here on Wednesday, honor guards and average citizens, police officers from across Maryland and beyond gathered to mourn Detective Sean Suter, who met a violent death on one of the most violent streets he had worked in his 18 years on the force. So here's a Baltimore policeman, 43 years old. He's married. He has 5 children. He served in the Army. It says, as Governor Larry Hogan characterized it, he dedicated his life to working in unsafe places in unsafe times. I mean, here's an exception where there's an officer who's not pulling back, but who's actually on the streets. Right there in West Baltimore, it says the last of those places that this officer went was on a narrow street in West Baltimore's Harlem Park, where Suter went November the 15th to search for new leads in a triple killing from December 2016 on that very block. He was investigating a triple homicide. Authorities said he confronted a suspicious man who, in a brief fight, grabbed Suter's gun and shot him in the head in a vacant lot. And so the police officer was gunned down. Now, you think about what would have happened if the reverse of that occurred. If the police officer, because he feared for his life, pulled his gun and shot the perpetrator in the head. I mean, that's been some of these cases that have gotten so much publicity. Excessive force. You think about the example in Ferguson. That's exactly what happened. Except that the policeman, he saved his own life because he shot the violent attacker. He shot him. Now, we don't know what happened in the confrontation, whether or not the police officer held back just because of what could have potentially happened to his career if accused of excessive force. In any event, I mean, the point that Hot Air makes is that what would you do if you were a police officer? Here was an unusual case of a brave 43-year-old officer who went into the danger zone investigating a triple homicide. And now he's dead. Well, when you look at that, the danger involved in these positions? And then when you look at what happens when you do use force, it's no wonder that they're pulling back. But here is a black pastor saying, we don't want them to leave. We need the police back in the neighborhoods. We need the police in West Baltimore. We need the police investigating these homicides. That's coming from someone right there on the ground, a local pastor in the Baltimore area. Is anyone listening to this man? Here's one more clip from that exchange on NPR, clip two.
Are you optimistic for 2018?
I'm not. Because as I look at the conclusion of 2017, these same cities, St. Louis, Baltimore, New Orleans, and Chicago, these same chocolate, these same black cities are still bleeding to death, and we're still burying young men in these cities. I want to be hopeful. I'm a preacher. I want to be hopeful. But as it stands, no. Not until we really have a real conversation with our frontline officers in the heart of our black communities that does not involve people who are quote-unquote leaders. We need the frontline police officers, and we need the heart of the black community to step to the forefront of this discussion. That's what's important. And that's when we're going to see a decrease in crime.
But is that going to happen? I mean, our cities are bleeding to death, as he said there. He doesn't have much reason to be optimistic about the year ahead. Here's a New Year's resolution that's not so good, is it? It's going to get worse. And we need to get the leaders out. We need to get the liberal journalists out of the picture and get the black community to come together and to work with the law enforcement officials. Well, that's the state of American cities bleeding to death, as this one black pastor has to say. Bleeding to death. Now, you look at America in general. Coming back to Andrew Miller's piece at thetrumpet.com today, featured in the February issue of The Trumpet, America's Retreat from Global Leadership. Well, this Observer piece, it goes by the title, President Trump Inherited a Hegemon in Decline, Inflicted More Damage. Listen to this history that it sums up here in just the first paragraph. The United States has been the world's greatest power since 1945, when that mantle half passed from London to Washington after the First World War, firmly landed in American hands after the Second World War. Since 1991, when the Cold War ended with Soviet collapse, America has been the world's hegemon, to use the proper term, the force whose power could not be seriously challenged on the global stage. That's the way that it's been from 1945 on. But now, as this article brings out, in recent years, I mean, we've seen dramatic changes. In fact, this article says in 2017, just last year, we've seen unmistakable signs that American hegemony, it's over. It's been waning for decades. Well, it draws attention to the last decade in particular, saying that a new age has dawned, even though it's still early and the sun is far from full. It says here, as Commander-in-Chief, in his first year in the Oval Office, President Trump has ranted and raved on Twitter almost daily. See, it's just like with the Iranian protests. And then the president gets up this morning and says, hey, we're watching. The Iranian people are suffering, and America is watching. It's not that far removed from the way Barack Obama responded in 2009. I mean, he came out and sided with the mullahs, as I said yesterday. But as for action, or lack thereof, it was just basically America watching as the mullahs crack down on the dissent. And that's what's happening now. Same thing. I mean, it's made worse today because all of those sanctions, here again, President Trump decried that. President Obama lifted the sanctions, and now the mullahs have taken all the billions. They've taken all the money, and the people are suffering. And that's true. But where are the solutions here? Are sanctions going to be reimposed? Are nations going to rise up against the mullahs to protect those who are suffering? Well, nothing like that has happened yet. It says, as commander-in-chief in his first year in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump has ranted and raved on Twitter almost daily, with no effect save to confuse our allies about what exactly is going on in D.C. De facto, America has two foreign and defense policies, what the president says and what our national security bureaucracy does. The gap between presidential rhetoric and actual policy toward the world grew throughout 2017. And it goes on to give the example of North Korea and all of President Trump's rants, you know, making fun of the leader, calling him Little Rocket Man and such. But you get to the end of the year and you look at where North Korea is. As I read yesterday, they've got the bomb. Now it's a matter of mass production. They have the delivery systems. Now it's just a matter of making more of them. And as the deranged lunatic heading up that little country said yesterday or over his New Year's Day speech, I've got the button right here on my desk. And the United States isn't going to act. They're not going to act militarily. They're not going to do anything. That's the leader of North Korea taunting the United States. It used to be nations couldn't get away with that because American hegemony, well, it was so super abundant. I mean, the superpower with superpowers, as Andrew Miller says in his article. You talk about a power. This Observer piece says, it should be noted that President Trump inherited a hegemon in decline. His predecessors did plenty of damage before the current Oval Office occupant decided to inflict more. It gives some history with Bill Clinton and the Balkans. Of course, we've written about that, how that we basically handed the Balkans over to Germany. We did Germany's bidding in that war. Germany wanted it done, and the United States spent all the strength. Then the war against terrorism following 9/11, George W. Bush, and this tremendous show of force in Iraq, in Afghanistan, while not going after the head of the snake. And to be straight about it, not really taking out the threat even in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, we still just only recently put down the latest radical Islamist group in ISIS, and then effectively, as we've been covering on this program, effectively handed over the nation, Iraq that is, to its neighbor, Iran, the head of the snake, the king of the south. The Observer says the loss of American prestige associated with the Iraqi and Afghan debacles is difficult to overstate. Plenty of the world was content to go along with American hegemony, so long as it was somewhat competent. It says further on, now Obama's biggest failures came elsewhere. His willingness to participate in the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. There's that. There's turning a blind eye to the North Korean nuclear project, empowering Iran, mishandling Syria, handing the Middle East over to Russia. This all happened under Obama's watch. His abandonment, it says here, of his own red line in Syria in 2013 was easily read as a grave strategic error, since Obama, in effect, outsourced U.S. policy in the Middle East to Moscow. He just gave it over to Russia. It says later, Putin and other malefactors got the message that Obama's America would not stand up to troublemakers who could push back. They got the message loud and clear. They've been getting the message over the past 20, 25 years that American hegemony is coming to an end. The Observer says Trump is a perfect fit for our era when all America has left is raw military power. I mean, here's what we have left. Our economy has been in decline for decades. Our divided society displays unmissable rot. And our politics are a partisan shamble in the aftermath of 2016. Look at America politically. Look at how divided it is. Look at its cities. Look at Baltimore. Look at the distrust. The distrust there in the black community for law enforcement. Look at the way law enforcement is disappearing. It's unmissable. You cannot miss this rot, as it says in The Observer. And here, all that we have left are all of these military armaments, and yet even that, as I covered yesterday, I mean, you have a Navy force, a naval force that's half the size of what it was a generation ago. The Observer says here, however, just how much military overmatch the Pentagon has left after a near generation of down-punching in the Middle East against fourth-rate foes without strategic success is now America's great imponderable. We have spent trillions of dollars in Iraq, Afghanistan, killing jihadists all over, and the price in military obsolescence and declining morale is evident to anyone who wants to see. You think about that prophecy in Leviticus 26 and verse 20. God says your strength will be spent in vain. I mean, you're going to spend strength. There's still strength. That's really what this Observer is saying. This article is basically saying all that we have left is this raw military power, this strength that keeps being misspent. It's spent in vain. Our Air Force, which hasn't faced a serious peer competitor in the skies since the middle of the Second World War, is shedding pilots at an alarming rate, while it has far too few F-22 fighters to maintain air dominance worldwide, which Washington has taken as a given for decades. Then look at the Navy, it goes on and says. Look at all these mishaps. The corruption come espionage scandal. While our fleet in 2017 demonstrated that it has lost grip on basic navigation at sea. Considering the U.S. Navy has been the guarantor of freedom of navigation on the world seas since 1945, the protector of international trade and the backbone of American hegemony, its sad decline has far-reaching consequences. Far-reaching indeed. And then this article concludes, that said, our Army is equally unready for battle against a peer. In its shadow war in eastern Ukraine, Russia's ground forces have demonstrated killing capabilities far beyond what America and NATO can do. The combination of Russian long-range artillery and electronic warfare has obliterated whole Ukrainian battalions. And right now, they would do the same to the U.S. Army. Talks about how we haven't invested in the latest technology and training to compete. To compete. Right now, the U.S. Army is frantically playing catch-up so it can take on the Russians as equals if it comes time to a fight. The conclusion says here, since 1945, it keeps going back to that date, that's the end of World War II. It was a smooth transition to power. I mean, you had the great British Empire, America's brothers, just hand over the mantle to the United States. And we've had these 70 years or so of relative peace in Europe and around the world. I mean, to be sure, there still have been wars and rumors of wars, as Jesus prophesied. But not since 1945 has the whole world been drawn into a conflict. Since 1945, Washington has presumed that it can deploy our military anywhere at the time and place of our choosing, thanks to our dominance of the world's skies and oceans. Even in a worse case, we could always get our forces home. This should no longer be assumed. The world has changed. American hegemony has collapsed. That's from The Observer just the other day, and you put it together with what Andrew Miller had to say at the Trumpet. It's featured today at the top of the website. It's in the latest Trumpet magazine. If you haven't yet subscribed to the Trumpet magazine, make sure that you get your free subscription at thetrumpet.com. I mean, this issue is loaded. It's loaded. There's a strong Jerusalem theme all through the issue as well. Jerusalem's the powder keg. America's retreat from global leadership. It's on display. To use the word they used in The Observer, it's unmissable. You can't miss it. Here we've been going on and on and on. I mean, almost two decades. Going on two decades. Fighting against a battle tactic, really. Instead of an evil. A nation that sponsors these tactics. These terrorist attacks. Oh, if sure, there's an occasional lashing out at Al-Qaeda and affiliates, at Saddam, at the Taliban, at ISIS. But the King of the South, I mean, it's stronger than ever. What do we have to show for going against all of these shadowy networks? And look at how the military's been hollowed out, just like it's covered in this article. And what about the moral decline? What about the leadership, the dearth of leadership? Isaiah 3 prophesies of this. There's no leaders to lead the United States. There's no strong leadership. We have been prophesying of this for more than two decades. We said at the start of the war against terrorism, following 9/11, the month after, that the United States didn't have the necessary will to win the war. The pride and its power, it's broken. That's Leviticus 26:19. And then the very next verse is the one that says we would spend our strength in vain. Herbert Armstrong said in the United States and Britain in prophecy, do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America? That's in his classic work on prophecy, written back in the 1930s, the first version of it, written almost 100 years ago. And it's coming to pass, all of it. It's happening. Do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America? There had to have been a lot of people who scoffed at that statement in the 1940s. In the 1950s, in the 1980s, in the 1990s. But look at where we are today. America is watching. Yes, indeed, that's about all that America is doing. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program if you like, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
All the faithful men and women of the Bible knew that this physical life of ours, that it's just a temporary thing. We're just temporary tabernacles, to use the language the Bible uses. And this is why true Christians need vision that reaches beyond this physical life, that reaches even beyond the millennium, as my father talks about in the Zechariah booklet. Beyond the millennium, beyond the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ on this earth. I went through Hebrews 11, or some of it, yesterday with you, there about Abraham, who looked for a city whose builder and maker is God. That's how he conducted his life. Here's a patriarch who lived thousands of years ago, and he looked beyond the thousands and thousands of years of this present evil world. He looked beyond the thousand-year millennium to New Jerusalem, a city built by God, God the Father. Abraham saw New Jerusalem and God's eternal family. Yesterday I gave you that quote. Well, I touched on it at the start of the first segment. Jerusalem today, plagued by violence and division, a symbol of this tragic, war-torn planet. But as my father goes on to say in that booklet, then there's Jerusalem above, the eternal's Jerusalem, the mother of us all, the source of power and understanding. He says, we are free in a way that is beyond human understanding. This picture, my father says, this picture of New Jerusalem helps us understand the brutal reality of Jerusalem and this world today. This is the picture. This is the vision. This is the hope that God wants us to wrap our minds around. This is the key to overcoming and conquering our adversary, to conquering our weaknesses and sins. This is how we endure to the end, by keeping this vision right at the forefront of our thinking. How could we ever endure if we let this vision slip away? Notice what it says in Revelation 3. Yesterday, I went through a few verses from Revelation 21 about this heavenly Jerusalem descending from God's heavenly throne, how that it has 12 foundations, plural, 12 foundations, how that it's going to be a beacon of light for all eternity, a beacon of light in the universe. It's going to be the universe's brightest light. God's presence will be there, this great, holy, majestic city, 1,500 miles in each direction. And those are the dimensions described in the last couple chapters of the Bible. And here in Revelation 3, it talks about true Philadelphians, pillars in the temple of God, pillars in God's house, because of their patience, their steadfastness, their faith, their obedience. God says in verse 10 about these Philadelphian saints, Revelation 3 and verse 10, because you have kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. This is speaking of Christ's return. Hold that fast which you have. Let no man take your crown. I mean, don't let anyone take your eternal position. God's talking about an imperishable crown. It's prepared for those who qualify for this family rule by overcoming Satan the devil, by overcoming their sinful nature. And what a reward. Verse 12 says, "Him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I'll write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name." I mean, people just can't believe these prophecies. They brush aside Revelation because, well, all the images and the animals and everything else, I don't understand any of it. But look at what God's describing. This is God's city, and it's going to come down out of heaven. This is where God's people, God's saints, God's pillars are going to be stationed for all eternity. Headquarters employees, you could say. True Philadelphian Christians, they have their minds on New Jerusalem. They're consumed by this vision in the Zechariah booklet. My father says here, we all need to really think about New Jerusalem and the time when the whole universe will be inhabited by the family of God. Human beings and all the problems we face on this earth will be gone. New Jerusalem will be here. So will God the Father. How much do we meditate on this vision, on this reality, this coming reality? Verse 21 says, "To him that overcomes," this is the Laodicean section of chapter 3, "to him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am sat down with my Father in his throne." I mean, if you overcome this Laodicean movement, this Laodicean falling away, if you answer Jesus Christ's knock at the door, and overcome the adversary, our adversary, the devil, then we're going to sit with Jesus Christ on his throne, even as he overcame and is sitting down with his Father on his heavenly throne, ruling with Jesus Christ. That's the vision. That's the New Jerusalem vision. Let me take you back to Zechariah. Yesterday we went through a few verses in Zechariah 1 and 2 where it talks about God yet choosing Jerusalem. Just to repeat two of the verses from yesterday, Zechariah 1 and verse 17. This is important again because of the context here when we get to the third chapter. But verse 17 of chapter 1 says, "Cry yet, saying, Thus says the Eternal of hosts, my cities, through prosperity, shall be spread abroad, and the Eternal shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem." Right at the time of this great world crisis, right here at the end of this age, God's talking about a time when he will yet comfort Zion. He will comfort God's people, even those that have fallen away from the truth, if they turn to him in repentance during the great tribulation. The church it's going to need comfort. The world needs comfort. Chapter 2 and verse 12, it says, "The Eternal shall inherit Judah his portion in the Holy Land and shall choose Jerusalem again." And so as I said yesterday, two times within these first two chapters, God reminds us that he is going to choose Jerusalem again. It's quite a contrast. Jerusalem today with the Jerusalem of tomorrow. But be assured, God repeats here that he is going to choose Jerusalem again. Now, I want you to notice what it says at the start of chapter 3. And some of you, if you've studied through Malachi's message, you're very familiar with this particular chapter. But Zechariah 3 and verse 1, it says, "And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Eternal, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Eternal said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke you, O Satan, even the Lord that has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire?" It says in the Zechariah booklet, God is showing us that the Laodiceans got into serious trouble because they stopped focusing on New Jerusalem. They quit thinking like God. God's mind is continually set on New Jerusalem. His entire plan is built around New Jerusalem. You can see why he wants us to think about New Jerusalem, to meditate on this. I mean, this is where his mind is. His entire plan revolves around this. This is the ultimate vision in the Bible, and it should be your ultimate goal. But isn't it interesting? You look at chapter 1 and chapter 2, and it says God will yet choose Jerusalem, or that he's going to choose Jerusalem again. And yet here in chapter 3, when he's addressing, when he's really talking about the church and a falling away from the truth, he tells his own people, look, I have chosen Jerusalem. I mean, you should know this. You should know the truth. Given all that you've received and heard over the years, I mean, you know you should know better. As my father says in the booklet, Joshua and his followers allowed their minds to stray from God's vision of New Jerusalem. That led to what is probably the worst disaster ever in God's church. You see how it happened? You see why so many fell away from the truth? They got away from this vision. You can read more in verse 8 says, "Hear now, O Joshua, the high priest, you and your fellows that sit before you, for they are men wandered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch." Christ is coming back to build New Jerusalem, or at least the millennial Jerusalem. And then New Jerusalem comes from heaven above at the end of the millennium. I mean, this is the kind of city this world hasn't yet seen. This is to be the capital city of the world and soon to be the capital of the universe. Big changes are coming to this city. I mean, eventually God the Father himself, as we've read, God himself will dwell in Jerusalem. New Jerusalem should be our greatest goal. That's what my father said in the Zechariah booklet. That should be our greatest goal. He says God is telling us that if we want to avoid being deceived, and if we want to live exciting, positive, hope-filled lives, then we must understand this vision of New Jerusalem. We must anchor our minds in this mind-inspiring hope. The fact that we think about New Jerusalem the way God does shows that we are his sons. That's what it shows. The context of these scriptures in Zechariah is God's people turning away. Notice how God tries to rescue his sons. He implores them to get their minds on New Jerusalem. That's how God tries to get us back on track. He wants to get our minds on Jerusalem. He wants us thinking about New Jerusalem. And if we do, as he goes on to explain in that booklet, I mean, we're not going to suffer from discouragement or despair. We're going to be filled with joy and hope because we have this vision right at the center of our thinking. That doesn't mean we won't have some difficult moments in life or some rough patches, as my father says in the booklet. But those trials will not overwhelm us. Not if we've chosen Jerusalem. If we choose Jerusalem, then even in the midst of sore trials and tests, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you see a tremendous positive. You see a tremendous opportunity there. Look over at Galatians 4. I think I might have touched on this yesterday as well. Galatians chapter 4, this is where it talks about Jerusalem above, the mother of us all. Paul here is talking about Abraham and the two sons that he had with the two different mothers, and how that these were two symbols. Ishmael's birth, of course, came by just a natural carnal process. Abraham took matters into his own hands. But Isaac was a son of promise. He was born by a promise that only God could fulfill. That was a miraculous birth. Paul says in verse 24, which things are symbolic, that's the meaning, for these are two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which genders to bondage, which is Hagar. And then verse 25 says, for this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and answers to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. So he brings up the subject of Jerusalem. He talks about two Jerusalems, as well as these two sons, one the physical or the carnal, and the other a righteous son of promise. And then this Hagar answers to Jerusalem, which now is, but the Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all. I mean, Jerusalem is like Isaac's mother, that this seed, this promised seed, came out from. Mr. Armstrong and Mystery of the Ages and, well, so many other books and booklets as well talked about this heavenly city, the headquarters of God's church. It's located in heavenly Jerusalem. That city's going to come down to this earth at the end of the millennium. Just one more passage here before we conclude. This is Hebrews 12. Switch over to Hebrews, also written by Paul, Hebrews 12 and verse 22. It says, but you are come. This is what happens when you come before God at baptism. When you turn to God in repentance, we had a couple of baptisms here in here at Edstone over the weekend. And Paul says here, but you brethren, you have come to Mount Zion and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels. You've come to a spiritual mount, not like Mount Sinai of old, or not to the Jerusalem, which now is. You've come to heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. You've come to God's church. You've come to heavenly Jerusalem. My father says in the Zechariah booklet, we are preparing for Christ's return to Jerusalem, where he will rule with his bride. Then for 1,000 years, we will prepare for the Father's coming to Jerusalem to rule his family there from there forever. And then my father goes on to talk about the intense interest that God's church has, even in the Jerusalem of today, particularly with respect to these archaeological discoveries. And here are the latest. This is not one that was found by one of Dr. Mazar's teams, but an important one nonetheless, a 2,700-year-old seal that talks about the governor of the city, or the governor of Jerusalem, something that you can read in your own Bible. And isn't it something if that particular seal happened to be the Joshua of Hezekiah's time? My father says God's goal is to get us and this world into New Jerusalem. That's his goal. That's where God is leading us. That's where this vision takes us. It takes us right into this heavenly city, talked about over and again in your Bible, in Zechariah, in Hebrews, in Revelation, in Galatians. New Jerusalem. What a contrast. The Jerusalem of today, a symbol of this tragic world, but New Jerusalem, that's the city that Abraham searched for. That's the city whose builder and maker is God the Father, You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments or suggestions or any feedback to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.